Welcome back, everyone. Today we have an amazing guest and a dear friend, Tolly Macris.
But then I realized that, wait, collectibles are something, especially these Panini cards and the Topps cards, is something that has existed for more than 50 years, right? They don't care who's the president of America today, tomorrow, who made a statement on Twitter, you know. That company, Panini, out of Bologna, owned by two brothers, is still making an average of 800 million euro profit per year. And their model is very simple. They go to FIFA, pay them X amount of money, I think 30 million or whatever for the rights. Then they go to their printing machines in Bologna, they're printing these cards, and they sell shit out of them worldwide, making 800 million euro. In the US, the very good attraction is always through the fighters. So I give you one example again, Dubai. We are in Dubai right now. Let me give you the actually most successful day we had in the history of EBTV. Back in 2016, there was an organization here called GFC, right? They did two massive events, then went bankrupt, right? On the second event, they had Badr Hari. Badr Hari is a famous fighter from K1. And that event was broadcasted live on Elite Boxing TV, right? On that day alone, when Badr Hari posted on his Facebook back then, right? Come and watch me live on the Elite Boxing TV. We had 1 million people signing up. Massive number, but it's a Badr Hari. This is a one time in 10 years occasion what happened, right?
You told me a fascinating story about why jiu-jitsu is so important for this region. Maybe you can share it.
So jiu-jitsu is under the patronage of His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, right? The vice president of the Jiu-Jitsu Federation is Mr. Abdul Munam Al Hashimi, right? Who is the president of the UAE Federation, but also the vice president of the International Federation. And what they have done here in the country is amazing. It doesn't exist anywhere in the world, right? They have implemented jiu-jitsu as part of the educational program and also in the, you know, military. Mm-hmm. So in the schools here, right, there is, I think, more than 120,000 kids in the schools training jiu-jitsu.
I like the word vision. I like this word, the vision 2030, the vision 2050.
Yeah, it's amazing. So what a lot of foreigners do a mistake when they come in here, you know, is that they come to one city, then they will talk with somebody that they just met, and they will go to another city, and then they're trying to leverage and say, oh, they'll give me this. This is the biggest mistake you can do here, you know. But then we came to the Middle East. Our second event was actually in Dubai.
Okay.
November 2010. Sheikh Zayed Road, Duzit Thani, at the back of the parking roof, right? Back then we negotiated a very good deal with the sports council, right? Because Burj Khalifa was just built, mm-hmm. and they needed promotion to promote it. We had a TV contract with ESPN to promote that, you know, event to more than 400 million homes.
Welcome back, everyone. Today we have an amazing guest and a dear friend, Tolly Macris, the founder of EX Sports. We're going to hear his amazing journey of growing up in Germany, how he accidentally ended up in Thailand and sparked off his amazing career in sports, esports, streaming, and being one of the key players in the region, in the UAE, but in globally, in bringing sports closer to the communities globally, and very importantly, being a pioneer in technology innovation and integrating Web3 into his highly successful business. My name is Anton Golub. You're watching Blogcast Podcast, and I'm here with my amazing co-host, Dr. Dimitrios Zaboglu. Have a blast and enjoy the podcast.
Awesome. So welcome to the show, Tolly.
Thank
really
you,
a pleasure
guys.
To have you.
Thank you for
taking
me.
The time. Coming all the way from Abu Dhabi?
From Abu Dhabi. 6 days of travel.
6 days.
How is the weather nowadays in Abu Dhabi?
Better than in Dubai.
Wow.
Because we're on the ocean right there. So yes. it's a bit cooler, yeah. I feel.
And how many years you've been living in Abu Dhabi?
Now 1 year. I was based in Dubai 2019 to 24, 5 years.
Yes.
Then got married, produced two babies, you know, and then moved over to Abu Dhabi, which is, you know.
Is it a common path to get married, get a family, and then go to Abu Dhabi?
Some of them doing it. Yes, obviously, yes. Both cities are, you know, very family friendly. Yes. For me personally, my connection was always in Abu Dhabi, mm-hmm. right? Since 2014, working with, you know, different partners there. When I decided to move here in 2019, right, one of the main reasons to move here, I saw the potential in crypto,
yeah.
right? And I knew that Dubai is going to move faster than Abu Dhabi, right? Yes. in certain things, which, you know, they have done that, right? They have moved faster. They attracted more people in the beginning. Now some moved over to Abu Dhabi. Some stay here, right? In the end of the day, it's one country. It's one nation, right? Yes. It's two different cities we live here. Yeah. And yeah, so it was always clear for me that if I come here, I'll move back to Abu Dhabi.
Yeah. You kind of hinted a little bit that, you know, you have some strong partners and collaborations in Abu Dhabi. For those who don't know you, I mean, you're famous, but for those few people who don't know you,
Can you tell a little bit more? I don't even have a social media channel. I don't know how famous.
After this podcast. So can you tell a little
bit more? You create an Instagram account.
He's one of the few Greek people that are famous, but he's very humble.
No, not really famous. So yeah, my background is in sports, right? Born and raised in Germany as a Greek, as he has mentioned. I'm originally Greek, born and raised in Germany. Mm-hmm. When I was 19 years old, I took a flight to Bangkok, which in that time I thought it's Vietnam. And then I realized it's actually Thailand.
So why did you want to go to Vietnam?
I wanted to leave, you know, from Germany for a while. And I thought, okay, I wanted to actually go first to Egypt. There was no flights available when I went to the airport. They were all booked out. So I saw that there was a promotion for Bangkok, 432 euro or something.
Deutschmarks.
No, it was a euro already. Okay. And then I thought, okay, perfect, Vietnam, you know, let's go there for 2-3 months, you know, come down a little bit, find myself and all of that stuff. Then I realized, no, it's actually Thailand. And I ended up there. Mm-hmm. And the 3 months that I planned originally became 14 years. I was based 14 years in Bangkok, right? Heavily working in Muay Thai. Yes. Right? First, I was fighting. Myself.
You were fighting before in Germany, or your first training and fighting was done in Thailand?
I was already training in Germany, a bit of kickboxing and boxing, but I didn't fight professionally. Okay. When I went to Thailand after 6 weeks camp in Sitiotong, I also then started fighting professionally, got my ass kicked, lost my 4 teeth, and then I realized that fighting is not for me. And I got 25 euro for my fight as a purse. Fixing my teeth, including flying back to Germany, cost me 2,500 euro. So I realized that fighting is not for me. Yeah. So I stopped that and then I went straight into the business.
Can you just go a bit back and say, what did this motivation came to do fighting? I mean, train fighting in, even in Germany? Because, you know, like in Croatia, you know how you start doing sports? It's like your father just grabs you one day and he says, like in my case, you're going to do swimming, you know, and then 7 years I did swimming, you know.
Yeah.
So was it like this, or was it a passion internally, or you watched fighters, you know, how did it came about?
For me, I grew up in Germany, surrounded only by immigrants in that time. Actually, my first German friend was in Bangkok when I was 21 years old, right? Mm-hmm. So we grew up in Germany, in Stuttgart, with lots of Serbians, lots of Croatians. No, it's a lot of Turkish. For us, it was all these immigrant groups.
Yeah.
And they're fighting each other every weekend anyway, which is happening now also in the UK, right? So most of the people, you know, most of immigrants, right, in Germany, in the UK, in France, right, that start training martial arts are either training because they need to control their aggression, right?
Okay.
Or they training to have a better self-defense, right? Because it's very common there. Now here in the UAE, we don't know these things. They don't exist. You know, all these fighting, say, you look at my girlfriend, you cut my line in the car. You know, this is common things in Europe right now, people fighting for. You should know you're from Croatia. You're probably even fighting because today was raining. Now, why did it rain? Two people fighting, right? He's from Cyprus, Greeks, you know, we're fighting for everything. But it's very extreme, you know, so, you know, but it's harmless. It's, you know, youth, teenagers.
Kids, fighting. Yeah.
Now it became a bit more disgusting, right? Now there's a lot of stabbing going on in the UK, France, Germany. It's out of control right now, right? Stabbings and shootings and stuff like this, right? But, you know, 25 years ago, it's us, you know, the Turks unite with the Greek. No, we actually never united with the Turks. But the Turks unite with the Serbians to fight against the Turks, and the Russians come in. So it's all like teenager drama on the streets. You know, that what got me in, you know, self-defense and also controlling aggression as a young, you know, kid, immigrant, growing up in Germany.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So you took the plane, you landed in Bangkok.
In Bangkok.
And then what happened?
I went straight into a training camp in Pattaya.
How did you find the training camp?
I just asked Muay Thai. I couldn't speak English. I arrived there. It was in the old Don Muang airport. I arrived there. There was, you know, these people that come up to you, taxi, taxi, you know. So I'm like, okay, taxi, taxi. I say Muay Thai camp, right? And then we drove out. It was Don Muang airport. And he was driving and driving, you know, and it's like, I came from Stuttgart, and Stuttgart is a city with 2 million people, right? Small, right? Small, and I'm from one of the suburbs, which is a town of 150,000 people. So when I landed and he started driving, right? I say Muay Thai camp. And he kept driving 1 hour and 20 minutes. And I just look at buildings, but I'm like, what is this, you know? So he actually took me out of Bangkok and brought me to Pattaya in a training camp called Sit Your Tongue. But I was in that time, I still think I'm still in Bangkok. That's how big Bangkok is. You drive 1 hour and 40 minutes, you know, and you're still there. So I ended up in that camp, started training, you know, and then tried to be a superstar fighter. Like I said, it didn't work out. 14th later, and a bunch of, you know, punches in the nose, I realized it's not for me.
Okay.
So I went back to Europe, went back to Germany. Mm-hmm. I had a tape, videotape from my first fight, showed it to, you know, my friends over there. And then 2-3 months after, you know, people from different countries in Europe, right, start calling me and saying, hey, you're the guy who went to Thailand for a training camp. You know, I want to also go. Give me some advice. Mm. And then I realized there's a business opportunity, right? I thought, okay, there's a lot of people, especially in the German-speaking countries, right, but also Austria, Switzerland, that want to travel to Thailand for a Muay Thai training camp, but they don't have the balls, right, to go in the plane and go there, right? And there is no travel agency that offer, you know, full packages. And you know, the Germans, Swiss and Austrians, they like everything to be organized and packaged. They want to get airport transfer, flight, you know, schnitzel, everything included in their package, right? So that's what I created first. I created a company called Thai Gyms, where I became a tour operator for mostly German speaking, you know, wannabe fighters that wanted to go and train in Thailand and get their ass kicked like me.
to ask you, how did they find out about you? I mean, was this the early days of social media, or how did this, what is it, was like the rumor was circulating around Europe, you got your ass kicked?
So like I said, I grew up in Germany, mostly like Lebanese, Palestinians, you know, and in Germany, they're like these clan families, right? It's like the Omairat family, one of them that I grew up with, they have like 10,000 cousins and 15,000 uncles, right? It's very, very common there, right? Yeah. It's huge families, right? So we didn't need social media. You speak to Osama, Osama has a cousin, you know, Ali, and Ali has a cousin, Ahmed, you know, and then suddenly somebody from Belgium calls you and say, my cousin, you know, who was the uncle with the, you know, it's like we have in Greece as well, but the Arabs have it on steroids.
Right?
So they started calling, right? We have similar thing in Greece, but a little bit more, you know, controlled, you know, with like average of what we have. Five uncles. We have actually big family. We actually with 7 uncles and aunts, kind of big. Now compared to my wife's family, who is Lebanese, who has 22 uncles and aunts and 150 first cousins, we are still amateur. So this is how the word spread.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw that there's interest. And, you know, I created a website back then called thaigyms.de, with my first website. Went back to Thailand, negotiated with one of the gyms, negotiated with Thai Airways to give me good prices on the tickets. Wow. And then I started moving about 30 to 40 people per month, you know. Wow. But I was then already based in Thailand and just, you know, and, hustling around there.
I don't remember if it was my friend Andreas or Anton that told me that you speak the language as well.
Yes, I speak.
How did you learn this difficult language?
I had no choice. 14 years. It's a long time.
You got a teacher, you got...
No. I don't read and write, right? Okay. But I speak. You learn it. You have no choice. I didn't speak English when I moved there. In the beginning, I learned some Tinglish. Hello, okay. Mister. How are you? Long time. thank God I improved my English a little bit. So I learned Tinglish and Thai first.
Yeah.
Because I only spoke Greek and German when I moved there.
And many times when we talk, you speak Serbian, Croatian very well also. Yeah. You're talented for languages, I think, yeah?
Because like I said, that's the advantage if you grow up in a multicultural, you know, environment, right?
So you then learn German when you moved to Thailand because that was your consumer friend?
I still don't speak German. no, obviously I went to school.
I'm joking.
You know, and all of that. I had no choice. But it's funny, you see, my father is 55 years in Germany.
Yeah.
55 years. Still refuses to speak German. My Arabic, I think right now, Fana, even my Arabic is 10 times better than him. And it's terrible, my Arabic. I think my Nigerian right now, after looking at the Nigerian map one time, is better than my dad's German after 55 years. Yeah. He's like one of these old school guys who lives in that country, refuses to learn. And his argument is, if they want to speak with me, let them speak, let them learn Greek. You know?
makes perfect sense.
But you see, the Serbians, the Croatians, the Turks, and the Greeks, they're like similar mentality, especially in this generation of my father.
Yeah, but you know, if you're a Croatian in Croatia, one of the first things they tell you when you start approaching going to school is like, you're going to learn English, you're going to learn German. So if you're in Croatia, then you learn probably better German than if you live in Germany, you know?
Well, I believe that because they have good education. You know, also the Croatian Serbians, the English is always better when I compare, for example, with the Greeks, you know? Because I think they're more serious in the school system to learn English than they do also in Greece, for example, right? Yeah. German English is terrible. You know, most of the Germans, yes. You know, and I know it because when I used to come and visit my family, right? For 20 years now, I'm out of Germany. And my partner comes from the States with me and stuff like this. And I realize how, you know, few people only speak good English in Germany, right? Mm-hmm. And also in Greece. Now, okay, if you go in Athens and everything, everybody speaks. But if you go in the North, where I'm from, they don't speak so good English,
they
right?
They don't speak English at all.
Yeah. But then when you go to Croatia and when we pass by in Serbia, 95% of the people, they speak very good English, you know? So they're more serious about that. In these countries, they're more serious about the education and stuff like this.
I agree. And tell us a bit more. So for 14 years, you were doing
Muay
tours?
No. The tour business was for about 2-3 years, right? We became big. So first I started with one gym. Then I partnered up with the biggest promoter in Thailand. His name is Songchai Ratanasuban. He also became my mentor. He was the biggest promoter in Thailand that organized 2 events per week in that time. So he was the Don King.
I like what you said. He became my mentor. How does he become someone your mentor? Because you remember we had this in the previous podcast.
With Rabi, yeah?
Yes.
With Rabi, yeah.
So first, one step back before becoming my mentor, he became my expansion plan and security backup. Because what happened is I started with one collaboration with one gym in Bangkok, right? But then I realized also that, you know, dealing with the gyms and gym owners is very risky, you know. For example, there was money coming into the account of the gym owners. They didn't want to pay me out. Then they started threatening me, showing me, you know, bullets and telling me how, you know, much it costs, you know, to get rid of me if I put too much pressure for my payments. You know, so I realized, I said, listen, if I'm in this business and I want to expand, I can only expand if I have a strong partner behind me, right? Mm-hmm. And after almost 1 year of operating and making good money for myself and for the gym owner, I realized either I, you know, find the right partner and expand, you know, without getting threats and all this BS anymore, or I just leave because it's not worth it, you know, to stuck in Thailand and eventually get shot by someone for, you know, 5,000 euro that he has, you know, received in the account. It didn't pay out. So I went to, in that time, you know, the biggest promoter, and it was a very straight up proposition. This is the business. This is how much money I made. I want you to be partner. I'll give you 50%. So first, you know, we became business partners. We then, within 3 weeks, expanded to 45 corporation gyms across Thailand. And nobody ever since then threatened me in Thailand, right? Because they couldn't do this anymore with a partner like that, right? So this is how then we expanded. And then we actually wanted to collaborate also and sell to Thai Airways, which saw a big potential in this whole sector of foreigners coming to the country to train, right? But then what happened is they started with the riots. They started, you know, taking down Thaksin, the ex-prime minister. Then 400,000 demonstrators went to the airport, shut down the airport for 16 days. Thai Airways almost bankrupt. The entire tourism industry almost collapsed in Thailand. Right. So we made a step back, you know, and then I thought, okay, I don't want to really go back into this anymore and build and become a tour operator. Where is the big potential? Where is my passion? And I saw it in the events, you know.
But did you sell the company, the tour operating company?
No.
Or you just closed it, or you transitioned
We transitioned it over, and then so first I was a business partner with him, and then we transitioned over where he became my mentor, because I said, okay, there's big potential in the events, right? because I saw that in the US, UFC was growing. Oh, yeah. You know, it became more popular, right? I realized that if UFC is becoming more popular, the demand for stand-up fighting will also increase, right? Mm. Muay Thai back in that time, 2006 to 2010 in Thailand, was considered a low-class mafia-run sport because it was, you know, hosted in two stadiums that have a license to bet. So gambling is illegal in Thailand. Mm. And when people want to go bet, you know, tuk-tuk drivers and all of these, they go into the Muay Thai stadiums and bet there legally because it's controlled by the military there, right? Mm. So that's why also, because it was linked with betting, it was linked with violence, it actually had a bad reputation. Mm. But I realized that in the next 10, 15 years, the industry will change. If UFC will grow, which it did, right? The demand for stand-up fighting will also increase. And broadcasters like ESPN, Fox Sports, Eurosport will also, you know, request more stand-up fighting content, right? Mm. But I didn't know this business. So I started then working directly for my old partner and mentor then. And for 6 years, I worked for him for free in order to learn the business.
Wow.
You know, and we did an average of 2 events per week.
And when you say events, those were then the stand-up fights, yeah?
Muay Thai fights. Muay Thai fights. 2 events per week for a period of 6 years, right? That was my training. And then in 2010, I created a company called Elite Boxing.
Yeah.
So I realized, okay, now is a good time to actually create a television format around the sport, right? So I flew down to Singapore, had a meeting with ESPN. It then rebranded into Fox Sports, but back then in the beginning, it was ESPN. And I told them, I said, I have a proposal to create a television brand for Muay Thai, right? Where the format is very simple. 5 Thais, gonna always fight 5 foreigners, right? So we created a brand called the Thailand versus Challenger Series, right? We committed to 6 events per year with ESPN. We launched on the 16 January 2010 in Bangkok, right? And for the first time also, we took the sport out of the traditional run betting stadiums into a high-end venue and created an entire entertainment product around it, you know?
Awesome.
So yeah, that's how the journey started. And then from ESPN, Fox Sports, Eurosport, we did more than 100 events all around the world.
Awesome. Wanted to ask you something you mentioned very specific. You wanted to kind of create a television style format, right?
Yeah.
So that means it was not just the fights. It was also the interviews, the preparation, the post fights. Was it like that?
Exactly. That content, you know, we built a production studio later where this content was very important in order to build emotional relationship with the fighter, right?
Yes.
But the format that I talked about is, look at football, for example, right? Even if you don't like football, right? What brings people together to watch a football match is that national pride, right? Mm. Greece against Turkey, right? Everyone, even if they hate football, they will watch it, right? Because it's that national pride. Serbia versus Croatia, you know? All of that. Cyprus versus Cyprus. Actually, Cyprus would be Turkey versus Greek, right? So, you know, in sports, the most successful, you know, events are all driven by emotion around the nation. You're behind your nation, right? And in Muay Thai, so the brand that we created, Thailand versus Challenger, was to create that format where, okay, today we are in Thailand and we have 5 foreigners from 5 different countries challenging the Thais in their home, right? Which was the launching event. But then we came to the Middle East. Our second event was actually in Dubai.
Okay.
November 2010, Sheikh Zayed Road, Duzzat Thani, at the back of the parking roof, right? Back then, we negotiated a very good deal with the sports council, right? Because Burj Khalifa was just built, and they needed promotion to promote it. We had a TV contract with ESPN to promote that, you know, event to more than 400 million homes. So here we did Thailand versus Middle East, right? So you have 5 Middle Eastern fighters going against the Thais. Then we went Thailand versus Germany, 5 Germans versus 5 Thais. So by creating this format, we now also increase the viewership and the interest of people because people want to see their country win, even if they don't understand the sport, right? And this is also, I think, 90% of football today. When there is a World Cup, 90% of the audience maybe don't understand football, don't care about football, but when it's World Cup, they're cheering for their countries, right?
Wanted to ask you something is that from your experience around martial arts sports, let's call it like that, is that you need to tell me if I kind of understood it correctly. I think maybe even you told me about is that in football, you have people getting very much attracted to a specific team, right? So it's maybe my national team or a team from my hometown, like Dinamo Zagreb, you know?
Yeah.
But in some sports, the sport is the brand, actually.
Yeah.
You know, like, for instance, F1 is like, even if you, I have no clue who are the teams, actually. I know there's Mercedes, Ferrari, I don't know, why is it McLaren, or, you know, like, but it's, people are less attracted to the teams, more about the sport. The sport is the brand. Exactly. Is it the same like this in my
Absolutely, 100%. UFC is the best example.
Okay.
So, for example, also what people don't understand, they think UFC is a sport. You know, UFC is not a sport. It's ultimate, it's a product.
Ah.
And it's a product out of mixed martial arts, right? This is also when people tell me, oh, UFC is going to go to the Olympics. I say, how? It's impossible, because UFC is a product that brings the best mixed martial artists together, you know? And mixed martial arts is a combination, especially when you fight in mixed martial arts. You have a combination of stand-up fighting, which Muay Thai is the best because you're using 8 weapons, and a combination of on-ground fighting, which mostly is jiu-jitsu, sambo, and stuff like this. Now, when you talk to Russians, the best on-ground fighting is sambo, you know? Putin is a big supporter of sambo, judo, you know? Khabib, they're all sambo guys. And the Dagestanis right now, they're beating everyone. So sambo is that. Before the Dagestanis kicked ass in the UFC, it was the Brazilians, jiu-jitsu, right? Jiu-jitsu. So as you have jiu-jitsu, you have sambo, right? Now, if you ask the Greeks, obviously, the Greeks will say it's all Greek wrestling, you know? They think it's still all from there, right? So mixed martial arts, right, is different disciplines. And what UFC did is they built a product around it, right? So this is the best example, right? Mm. They're not a sport. They are a mix of different sports, mix of different sport federations coming together to kick the ass and see who is the best, right? Yes. And sometimes the Brazilians are the best, and then the big hype is about jiu-jitsu because it's the best on the ground. And then sometimes Dagestanis come and kick ass, and suddenly sambo the best, right? So maybe next year some kung fu master from China comes and kicks ass, and then it's kung fu. I don't know, right? But that's a good example.
Almost
of
2 billion Chinese. Someone will come for sure. Maybe not this year or next year, but someone is definitely coming, and it will be big, and he will be strong, and he will know new things for sure.
Wanted to ask you, just to continue on that, is that you are very successful and pioneering in implementing new innovative technologies into martial arts. You can argue they've been forever, actually, right? I mean, you mentioned the disciplines, but they have been forever. Can you tell us or walk us through your vision or how this idea sparked? Because you actually implemented a lot of Web3 aspect into your eXports, but I think you can also then explain about that.
Yeah, 100%, perfect. So I'll go back, you know, in the beginning, how I started. It's the traditional business. The traditional business as a promoter is, I rent a venue, and when I rent a venue now, I make the event, and I produce it, and then I give it or sell it to the networks.
Mm.
I work with ESPN, Eurosport, you know, and all of these channels, right? And in the beginning, in the first 1-2 years of Elite Boxing, we gave the content for free. You know, we created 52-minute tapes. We gave the content for free. They shared from the 8 minutes, you know, they shared us 50% of the commercial time. And then we resold the 4 minutes commercial in order back to our sponsors. And we offered our sponsors a mix of on-ground and on-air commercials, right? So this is how we financed in the beginning the events. And then later, after we became a brand, the networks also started paying us money, right? But the money you receive from networks is always limited, right? So there is no unlimited potential of money you can do by creating a product. It can be a podcast, it can be a TV show, right? You will always have a limit of how many potential media networks will buy it. Same, if you go with your podcast right now and package it, bring it to a distributor, maybe they can find you 8 channels that will actually pay for the content, right? Same thing in sports, right? But for me, and this is also limits your potential income, right? Because when you have the arena has 5,000 seats. You can't sell 8,000 tickets. You can only sell 5,000 seats. Correct. You can only sell one title sponsor package. You can only get X amount of money from the TV broadcaster. And, you know, if you're Greek and you make some souvlaki on the side or some falafels, right, you can maybe sell another 1,000 falafel sandwiches, whatever, right? But what I'm trying to say is your revenues are limited, right? But in 2013, I realized, why do I produce, take all the financial risks, and give the broadcasters the content for a certain amount of money, right? I can just build a platform where I can now actually stream the event through the internet, mm-hmm. charge the people pay-per-view, right? And then unlimited potential of making money, right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, even in pay-per-view, there's a limited potential. But look at UFC. UFC makes billions from pay-per-view income, right? Because then you don't need the broadcasters. And that's the first transition that I did from traditional business into tech. In 2013, we launched a streaming platform called EBTV. Mm. So then we realized after 3 years doing events, spending millions of dollars all around the world, and giving it for a limited amount to the broadcasters, we realized, let's build our streaming platform and sell it there, right? And that's what we did. 2013, we launched EBTV. We then brought our own content into the platform and sold it. And then we also became a platform for third-party content providers. This was a beautiful opportunity for us, because now suddenly we had people in Croatia or in Serbia who had the same problems that I had, but they wanted a streaming partner that had the technology solution for them. Mm-hmm. And then our model was very simple. Anton, you're in Croatia, you put a show on, no problem. We stream your event, you set the price, 10 euro, 70% for you, 30% for us. Mm-hmm. And then we scaled that platform and did more than 800 events on that platform streaming. 90% third-party content, right?
Third-party content, actually.
Okay. Yeah, so we became a streaming solution for, you know, smaller, but also some big brands, you know, in the sport.
Tolly, can I ask you, because I'm just like trying to understand the business model in my mind, you know, and on one side you have the content, and as you say, mostly from third parties, right?
Yeah.
But it's a kind of like a marketplace. You need the other side, which is the viewers.
Yeah.
How do you get the viewers, actually, right, on the platform? Yeah.
The viewers, the very good attraction is always through the fighters. So I give you one example again, Dubai. We are in Dubai right now. Let me give you the actually most successful day we had in the history of EBTV. Back in 2016, there was an organization here called GFC, right? They did two massive events, then went bankrupt, right? On the second event, they had Badr Hari. Badr Hari is a famous fighter from K1. And that event was broadcasted live on Elite Boxing TV, right? On that day alone, when Badr Hari posted on his Facebook back then, right? Come and watch me live on Elite Boxing TV. We had 1 million people signing up. Massive number. But it's a Badr Hari. This is a one time in 10 years occasion what happened, right? But to answer your question is, you know, the fighters, they have big communities, right? Because also we didn't work with amateur fighters. We only worked with already existing famous top fighters, right? So, and the average, you know, even then, the average followers per fighter in that time, I would say, is about 100,000 people, you know? So fighters bring in a lot of, you know, new viewers.
So this is like a beautiful business model, because they bring the content, right? And they bring the viewers, right, actually. So with one counterparty, with one partnership, actually they bring both sides to the platforms. That's the beauty, right?
Exactly, actually. Exactly.
But nowadays, this is what I wanted to ask Tolly as well, is that you can have these fights between influencers as well, who are not really athletes. And this is also amplifying a lot the event. Have you done such partnerships?
Yeah, we have done two events here in Dubai, actually three events here in Dubai, called Social Knockout. So I did all the production for my partner here, Tam Khan, who is the biggest player in Dubai. 4,000 members in the gym in Media City, you know. It's the biggest brand, a very good friend of mine. So I had them also on the production. Our deal was, I come in as a production partner, I come in as a friend, but the streaming of the events goes on, you know, the eXports platform. Mm. So the first event we did in 2022, Coca-Cola Arena, right after COVID, 10,000 tickets sold. I think about 80 VIP lounges, each of them was 10,000 dirhams, right? Completely sold out, right? Massive success on the event. And eXports was the exclusive streaming platform. So on that night alone, we registered 32,000 new users in one night. And it was funny because the day before, I was talking to the Solana team. I was actually developing already my blockchain-based fan engagement platform that includes streaming. And the team of Solana, because we built it on Polygon and then BNB chain later, the team of Solana asked me, how are you going to onboard users? So look, you know, wait. So one day later, you know, I sent them only the Google Analytics, 32,000 new registered users on one night, right? Because the event was an influencer boxing event, which was, you know, clown show, but it was good, right?
Viewers.
But it brought, you know, and it was a pay-per-view event, huh?
Pay-per-view event.
It brought in 32,000 new registrations in one night, right? So that was the first event, which shows that, you know, that with the streaming, right, and content, which is still king, you can always bring in new users. And that's also the biggest topic in Web3, right? Yes. How you're going to bring in new users, right? Then obviously from 2022 until 2024, we developed hard. We built a platform, we developed games. We have two existing mobile games that are up and running. One of them is a camel racing game called Al-Hajin. The other one is a street football game that we built, you know, and promoted with BNB Chain and Binance NFT Marketplace. So on that use case, which happened 6 months ago, right, was again influencer fight with the midgets. There was this big midget fight here in Dubai, right?
I like how you say big midget fight, you know.
Big fight with the two midgets. And we brought in, it was again on eXports, 15,000 people watching it live on our app. The average spend time was 26 minutes. But here's the interesting thing. Now it's a Web3 fan engagement platform. 15,000 people come to watch the midgets fighting for 15 minutes, right? But within 48 hours after, we had 861,000 transactions, engagement inside the app. So suddenly people who came to watch a fight now claimed a free camel to join the camel racing game. Some of them claimed a free urban ball, you know, player to play the urban ball game, right? So this is, you know, where we believe with eXports also, we're going in the right direction, right? Content is still king. And it brings in new users every week, right? Less when you do pay-per-view, more when you do it free to watch, right? But when you bring them into a platform and you have, you know, additional things to offer them, they actually stay and they actually engage, right?
Awesome.
And this is also why we actually then transitioned from a only streaming platform into becoming a Web3 fan engagement.
Can you explain us a little bit what you mean by Web3? Because many of the people that will be watching this podcast have no idea what is a Web3.
Including me. So, because look, guys, I'm not a tech guy. I'm a traditional, you know, events
what
guy.
Is Web3 for you?
The blockchain technology. So for me, you know, when I came from, you know, doing traditional events into streaming, right? Mm-hmm. I knew that the streaming is going to be on the internet. Now, how the internet works, I don't give a shit, right? Who is behind, centralized, not centralized, I don't care. It's the internet. You know, I don't care how it works. I don't care how the light works. You know, if it's on, it's on. If it's off, it's off, right? Don't care how the air condition works. I know if it's off right now, you're all going to sweat your ass off, right? So for me, the thing is like this. When I went into that, I said, okay, why do I build a streaming platform? It's because I want to make more money. And the internet is a place where you can make unlimited money because you have unlimited reach, right? Yeah. Now, how the internet works, I don't care. We did 800 events, we built the platform up, we made money, right? So when I transitioned over in 2019 and looking into blockchain technology, right? In the beginning, I make this mistake, right? I went to Switzerland, I hired a boutique agency, you know, I bought a book, blockchain, I read two pages, and then I realized, shit, I don't understand nothing. And I will never understand how the blockchain will work. And it doesn't matter because, you know, for me, I'm looking at it as a technology
just
solution.
Don't worry, we have Anton here. He can explain to us how it really
exactly.
works.
Okay. So for me, I looked at it and say, okay, what is this blockchain, right?
Yeah.
What is the core benefits on the blockchain? Authenticity and the three, four things, right? And then I say, okay, it's a good technology to build a loyalty rewards program on top of it. And if you have a loyalty and rewards program that you can cash out, right, then you also have a cryptocurrency which requires to build on the blockchain, right? Yeah. So I understood enough that blockchain technology is needed in order to build on that to be able in the future to maybe launch a token. But when we got into the space...
I think it's really good for rewards because there is the trust element. Nobody can cheat you.
Exactly, right? So for us right now, when we got into the beginning, right, we hired an agency. The agency looked at what we already have because we had an existing ecosystem. We had business going on, right? Events, gyms, and all of that, right? So they came to us and they proposed us these collectibles, right? Which in the beginning, I thought the guy is insane. You know, what is this collectibles, right? But then I realized that, wait, collectibles is something, especially these Panini cards and the Topps cards, is something that has existed for more than 50 years, right? They don't care who is the president of America today, tomorrow, who made a statement on Twitter, you know? That company, Panini, out of Bologna, owned by two brothers, is still making an average of 800 million euro profit per year. You know, and their model is very simple. They go to FIFA, pay them X amount of money, I think 30 million or whatever for the rights. Then they go to their printing machines in Bologna, they're printing these cards, and they sell shit out of them worldwide, making 800 million euro. Mm. They don't care where is the market now, stock market up, Elon Musk inside, outside, Twitter post, this one. This business works, right? So I looked at it and say, hey, it actually makes sense, because the problem with Panini is they only focus in football. They never cared about sports like Muay Thai, Jiu-Jitsu, the ones that I'm involved in, you know, because it's too small for them. So I thought, okay, it's going to be a time where collectibles will be available digitally, right? And if you have a collectible, digital collectible, where you can also prove its authenticity and it's, you know, only a certain amount of pieces, it will create more value for it, right? And this is why we went into that digital collectibles that later became that whole NFT hype, you know, because it made sense. You look back, it works. It's always going to work. It has always worked, but it didn't really transform over into digital yet. And when it goes into digital with the new technology of blockchain to be proven to be authentic and whatever, you have only 1,000 unique pieces, you can then create a whole story, loyalty and rewards program around it. And that's how we went into it, you know, slowly.
Wanted to, so first of all, fascinating. I mean, I know in detail your story, but fascinating to hear it again. And wanted to ask you, you know, we're always talking about onboarding people into Web3, but you have a successful business that lives, that lived outside of the Web3 crypto space. And you shared this story when the Solana team asked you, how are you going to onboard clients, right? You said, look, tomorrow, and you showed the results.
Yeah, wait and see.
They were very clear, right? How does Web3 world industry understand the real business, you know? So, because we always talk about you need to onboard people into crypto, into Web3, as if we are the smarter ones and we're more advanced ones. But how does the Web3 understand the real world? For instance, did you find the right support from these blockchains? Did you find the right support from the key stakeholders, from exchanges, from NFT marketplaces? Did they understood what you're doing, which is phenomenal?
Yeah, absolutely. They understood, you know, some of them supported us. But the problem with that industry in general is, you know, when the market is good, they're all hyped up and positive. Mm. When the market is shit, you know, they're all kind of salam alaikum, alaikum salam, right? So that's one problem. So you can't really actually, you know, 100% rely, right? Mm. Then on the audience and the supporters also, they're not really loyal compared to, you know, a fan community of a sport, you know, they're very short-term minded, right? So it's very difficult to get into the space and get full support with short-term minded people, right? But we got support. For example, in 2022, when we partnered up with Sean Garnier to build the Urban Ball game, you know, our partnership exclusively on that IP was with Binance NFT, right? So they saw that they need IP on the Binance NFT marketplace. We were still in the development process of it, you know, of the app. Right. And we thought, OK, we don't want to waste time until our platform is ready. Let's move some of our IP, like, you know, Sean Garnier, and move them exclusively on the Binance NFT marketplace and also build on the BNB chain. Right. Which, again, they understood that some of these IPs will bring value over. And if you build a real utility after on this NFTs like we did with the game, right, people will then also transform over and engage there and cause them more transactions and stuff like this, you know? So yeah, some of them, you know, understand it.
What are the events that you're doing? You said you're not doing just Muay Thai. What other events do you do?
Mixed martial arts, boxing. We work very closely here in the UAE with the Jiu-Jitsu Federation, right? Okay. Yep. So the International Federation of Jiu-Jitsu is here based in Abu Dhabi. Actually, the first use case for us with NFTs, right? Digital collectibles, was done with the International Federation of Jiu-Jitsu in Abu Dhabi.
You told me a fascinating story about why jiu-jitsu is so important for this region. Maybe you can share it.
So jiu-jitsu is under the patronage of His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, right? The vice president of the Jiu-Jitsu Federation is Mr. Abdul Munam Al Hashimi, right? Who is the president of the UAE Federation, but also the vice president of the International Federation. And what they have done here in the country is amazing. Doesn't exist anywhere in the world, right? They have implemented jiu-jitsu as part of the educational program, and also in the, you know, military. So in the schools here, right, there is, I think, more than 120,000 kids in the schools training jiu-jitsu, right? There is more than, I think, 80,000 soldiers in the army training jiu-jitsu, right? So it's a sport that is supported from the top level, right? It promotes discipline, you know, it promotes confidence, it promotes strength, right? And, you know, they started it here, I think 15 years ago, and they realized it's good for their nation, and they became the biggest, you know, palm spotters, the one that is dealing with all of the coaches between the Ministry of Sports and Ministry of Education. They became the biggest company in the world to provide the jiu-jitsu infrastructure. It's amazing what they have done here with the sport. Yeah. So our first use case back in 2019 already, you know, about NFTs and collectibles, was done with the International Federation of Jiu-Jitsu. But the use case was done in Abu Dhabi. And then we presented that use case at the Sport Accord Convention in 2019 in Australia, right? To every president of every sports federation, right? Because our goal was to educate other federations, right? About the opportunities in blockchain and how they can also use this technology to create new revenue streams, right? So for us, you know, we had to create a use case somewhere, and we chose Abu Dhabi. We chose jiu-jitsu as a sport, not Muay Thai. And we presented this use case in 2019 to every decision maker of every sport federation. But back then, the problem was nobody had a clue what we're talking about. I think 95% of the people didn't even know what Bitcoin is, 2019, right? So we were very early on, right, trying to educate these federations that they can use this technology to create new value.
Maybe
right?
We can ask Anthony, what is the ratio nowadays of someone knowing what is a Bitcoin or a cryptocurrency?
I think globally we're under 20%.
Still, huh?
Yeah, still.
Even so, with all this hype and all this drama?
Even with all this hype and all this drama, it's, you know, many times they say in innovation, have you crossed the chasm? Like, you know, chasm? Like, have you tipped over? Have you passed the tipping point? You know, and do you have enough people that this spreads, technology spreads kind of organically, you know, let's call it like that, the way, same way that internet did. And then you realize, you know, people make this comparison, where are we with crypto now? Yes. And then some say, oh, we're in the 2000s before, in the internet context, we're before 2000s before Facebook came out. But if you look at the numbers, we're more like in the late 80s of internet.
Really?
You know? It's because
even
it's
my grandmother knows what Bitcoin is, bro. She doesn't know what the internet is, but she knows Bitcoin. She says, when are you going to buy me one Bitcoin?
Because Bitcoin went up recently.
If you're buying Bitcoins, I also want one.
Yeah.
But I think Anton wants one too.
Yeah, I think you can. I mean, but also it's like you are pointing out, like the question is always, are you one of the early people or companies or entities who benefit from the technology? Because you can reap a lot of benefits if you're one of the, not the earliest movers, because also you told me in 2019 it was like maybe a bit too much for most people. But if you're one of those early movers before it really takes off, I mean, you can benefit like crazy. But to be honest, I'm like very honest about this. When I see a lot of these wallets, exchanges, how complex it is, how not easy to easy it is. Like Panini, right? It's the cards, right? You know, that's it. You know, it's so simple. Anybody understands. But NFTs, I mean, if I have to tell my father to get a wallet, I mean, he will take out the leather wallet. My father is a veterinarian. He did leather business before. He would take out the leather wallet and say, here it is. Put the NFT inside. I think that my is my personal opinion, actually. But
no, for us, we were too early also on that use case. Sometimes it's not too good to be too early.
No, 100%.
Because we burned too much cash. 2019, 2020.
Timing is very, very important.
Yeah. So for me, I don't want to be number one anymore. The first. You know, also with that whole Muay Thai thing in 2010, we were like the first, right? But I realize it's better to be number three, you know, number four. Because you look at number one, two, three, what they're doing wrong, and then you come in later. Because number one always burns too much cash in trying to educate, right?
Yes.
And then you try to educate them in 2019, 2020, they don't pay attention. Suddenly there is this new word NFT hype in 2021. And the same guy's calling you and say, hey. You want to still do the NFT thing? I say, yes. Okay, $1 million for my rights. I say, bro, 2 days ago you didn't know what NFTs is. Now you want $1 million for the rights for it, you know?
Yeah.
So this is also the problem, that hype and that bull market in 2021, 2022, you know? then also the problem is, the negative effect is, it suddenly, you know, increased the IP cost too much, right? Because everybody start thinking that, oh, I'm sitting on gold, right? 2 days ago, I didn't know what NFTs is or what blockchain is, but now I'm sitting on $1 billion, you know, licensing rights, right? And then what happened is the market crash. The same people call you again and say, bro, please, 50 euro, you can have it, right? So this is the problem, you know, when you're trying to build something long-term, right? Yeah. Because it's long-term. But you're in these crypto cycles, you can benefit. Obviously, we also benefited. But you have also a lot of problems that you have to fight in, you know?
That's true.
So for us, the bull market, you know, was not good for acquiring new IP, even though we did. We did the Maradona NFT collection, which we did a big event with DMCC, you know, back then. We did a partnership with Sean Garnier, which is one of the top brand ambassadors of Red Bull. So we had some, we did the World Tennis League, Djokovic and all these guys, NFT rights. So we did some prime IP, right? But that IP is too overpriced because everybody thinking, you know, that it's too valuable, right? But if you don't build something sustainable around it, and if you don't build something with real utility around it, it's worth nothing. Right? It doesn't matter if it's on blockchain, internet, whatever it is, right?
Do you see any other company in the region that you will classify them as your competitor?
There's other big players, much bigger than us at that moment, right?
For example.
Today also, you know, like, but they're not exactly what we're doing, right? We still, what we do, and if you download the eXports app, you will see, you know, the way we're doing it is different. So there are certain people like Socios, right, in Chile, they're doing only fan tokens, for example, right? Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, huge, right? Depa Labs was big, you know, with their NFTs on the collectible moments, right? But they kind of disappeared right now. So there is these other, you know, groups in sports that are doing big things that were very successful in the last bull market, right? Way above us, not, cannot compare. But they don't do exactly what we do, right? Yeah, what we do is, our focus is one place for all different esports to become an aggregator for all these different esports, you know, more than 30, 40 different federations, right? Where you have a marketplace and a crowdfunding platform that allows athletes to issue their NFT, raise money for their camps, training initiatives or whatever. Then it's a streaming platform. It is a marketplace where you can redeem your earned tokens, you know, for any experiences. And it's a gaming platform where if you didn't find any product in the marketplace, you can actually right now buy a camel and join the camel racing game, you know? So it's also gaming included.
Did you branch out to e-gaming players like they do all of these Counter-Strikes or Street Fighter games? Are you thinking about putting this kind of electronic athletes in your platforms?
There is the biggest group here in the Middle East, in Dubai, is called NASA Esports. So the owner is a good friend of mine, Lalit Vaza. I've known him since 2018, 2019. He has 45 pro players and runs one of the biggest teams, right? We have tried some collaboration with them, but the problem that we realize is the games that we produce, right, are completely new IP that we produce, right? And they're not the games that these hardcore gamers play. Right? Yeah. So it's very difficult if you are a hardcore, if you are, let's say, for example, you are the Tekken Master or FIFA. You are the FIFA number 3 ranked player in the world, right? Of this team, right? The audience around you, even if you have 5 million followers, the only thing they want to see from you is how you play FIFA. Once you now promote another game that is not FIFA, and it's a 1v1 urban ball game that we created, right? Mm-hmm. And launched on eXports, then they don't care. They're not interested, right? So the conversion of a professional gamer into a new game on mobile that is not the game that they promote is very difficult. We have tried it, right? And it doesn't really work.
But the beauty of this is that your platform allows streaming and live streaming. So you're a sort of a kind of Kick, a kind of YouTube Anton. And you can bring all of these players to actually play their games. And people will actually watch because all the audience is digital audience.
Yes, but only if they play their games. So for example, let's say, okay, you are now again the FIFA master, right? And actually, when we did the podcast on the roof of the St. Regis Hotel, back in 2022, right? We had a we built a football pitch on the roof of the St. Regis in the Nakheel in the Palm. And we invited 8 special guests, right? That came and actually also tried our game. It was in partnership with Sean Garnier. The whole theme was about street football because it was around World Cup time. We built a football pitch on the roof of the St. Regis. We donated this football pitch, you know, to one of the slums in Africa. And we used that football pitch as a podcast, right? To go and talk about what we're doing, talk about the World Cup, talk about the results, and have these people try our games. Yeah. So Red Bull brought us the number one FIFA player, MS Dosari, from Saudi Arabia, right? World famous guy, right? I think 6 million followers or something like that. He came on the podcast. They talked about, you know, France, Mans, you know, whoever wins the World Cup, right? And in the end of the podcast, they also then played the game, right? So we realized that once now the guy who is known to play FIFA plays a game that is not FIFA, people don't care to watch. Mm. And if I bring this guy right now and I pay him to play FIFA on my platform, what's the point, right? Because it doesn't really help me. Mm. I'm not going to make any money if he is actually playing FIFA. Mm. But if he plays my game, Urban Ball, I make money because he will need to have an NFT. He needs to play. Yeah. He needs to upgrade his player, you know? And all of these collectibles are generating revenues for us.
Mm-hmm. Tolly, can you tell us a bit more about what are your future plans, especially maybe here in UAE, in Abu Dhabi, Dubai, maybe the region, globally? Mm. What are your plans? What are you working on that we should know, the audience should know?
I want one more kid. I think my wife will not agree on that. So I have 2 now. I want another one. That's plan number one. Have
plan
3
number
of them.
Top priority.
I think I'll stay in Abu Dhabi. I love the UAE. In the region, for me, it's a top place. And my wife is also convinced with Abu Dhabi right now. It's beautiful.
And business-wise, it's also
business-wise,
for you.
Everything, you know. UAE is one for me, right? Abu Dhabi is for me home right now. I love it there. So I'm definitely going to be based for a very long time over there, right? We are coming to Dubai every weekend because my wife's family is still here. So we have an agreement to be here every weekend, right? I lived here for 5 years, so if I'm out for more than 2 weeks, I also miss it.
You said you have an agreement with your wife?
With my wife, yeah.
Okay. So stamp and sealed.
Stamp and sealed and signed 5 times, you know, and halal approved and everything, right? So we come here still often to Dubai. I still have a lot of friends in Dubai, so yeah. I love to come here. We are very active right now in Saudi. Mm. At the moment, we have some partnerships there.
How did you find the difference in culture of UAE and Saudi? I think it's very similar nowadays.
Same, same, but different, what they say in Thailand. Yeah. No. Same, same, but different. It's not similar, not similar. Not similar.
When we had a podcast in the past again with Anton and we touched, I think that in the future, all of these GCC countries will be aligning, especially when it comes to technology, when it comes to areas like yourself, like sports. I think there will be many, many parallels.
Yeah, 100%. They're all aligned. And what I love about here is they have this friendly competition, right? Mm. So it's good because the way they're competing against each other is only growing everything, mm. right? And that's the beautiful thing here. You know, so there's always this constant competition between yes. this country and this country and this country. You know, I know where I want to live at this moment right now is in Abu Dhabi. This is where I feel comfortable. I'm every week in Saudi. I'm doing business there. We're expanding also there, right? You know, maybe I'm going to move there also in the future for a while. You know, for me, all of them are growing. All of them have their strengths. Mm-hmm. All of them have their visions and all of them competing against each other in a very positive way, you mm-hmm. know. So if you're part of that, you know, competition, you will automatically grow, right?
I like what you said, the word vision. I like this word, yeah. the vision 2030, the vision 2050.
Yeah, it's amazing. So what a lot of foreigners do a mistake when they come in here, you know, is that they come to one city, then they will talk with somebody that they just met, then they will go to another city, and then they're trying to leverage and say, oh, they give me this. This is the biggest mistake you can do here, you know? Because again, you are small fish in this here, right? There's a lot of sharks over here, right? And you can't play these games of, oh, they give me this, I give me this, you give me this, you know? It's like, for me, it's very simple. Where do I feel home now? I feel there. Where do I have a lot of support from before already. It's in Abu Dhabi, from my, you know, relationship with the Jiu Jitsu Federation and my relationship with some other partners there, right? They've always respected me, always supported me, right? Where did I come in 2020? Because I realized it's going to be the best place for crypto to move fast. It was Dubai.
Yes.
And we all agree on that, right? And now...
I think it's still number one.
It's, yeah. I think sharing right now between Abu Dhabi and Dubai, right? Because a lot of big groups went to Abu Dhabi. Some stay here. Again, in the end of the day, don't forget, it's one country. Just two different cities.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes people decide to move left, and that's the right. But the biggest mistake that foreigners do here is like, oh, if I go there, they give me this. If I give me this, you know.
No.
They forget that in the end of the day, you know, the people here are very united, and they have no tolerance for this BS games. Oh, they give you this. If they give you this, go, right?
Yes. Mm.
And this is, I think, people make a mistake right now also with Saudi. Oh, if I go to Saudi, go this. You know, go there. Nobody will bother you to not go anywhere and do something, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think the best way, if you stay in this region, right? You work with everyone, right?
Work with everyone, yes.
You're part of them competing against each other, and you try to be a small piece of that overall growth that they have, right?
Yes.
And when you say about sports and stuff like this, when you now zoom out and look at the world, this is going to be one of the best places in the world.
Yeah, because sports unites people. This is
exactly,
the beauty of it. But I will ask you where people are going to see you this year until the end of the year. We've seen you with Anton at the AIBC. What was it called, the conference?
Sigma has organized AIBC with a focus on Web3. You're one of the esteemed speakers.
Yeah.
So it was always nice to spontaneously bump into each other together with Andreas, who is busy there. And what's the next plans for you? Where can people? And also, maybe you mentioned UAE, the region. Are you doing something globally?
For us, first of all, for clarifying, our deals always with federations are always on the international federation level.
Mm.
So we never actually deal with the national federation. For example, let's say Muay Thai. I wouldn't deal with IFMA Croatia, even though I know the guy from IFMA Croatia, right? Or in Cyprus, because already I deal or I have my deal done with the international federation level, right? So for us, we always, when it comes to the IP deals, right? Let's say, for example, an IP that we created together with Sean Garnier. Sean Garnier is based in Dubai, but he has 23 million followers from all around the world. Mm. Out of them, 8 million followers are in Brazil, right?
Mm.
The 2022 campaign that we did also with Binance, you know, and this whole Urban Ball campaign, we generated 2 billion views. Out of the 2 billion views, 72% is outside of this region, right?
Mm.
So for us, our goal when we do deals with IP partners is always global, right?
Mm.
The beautiful thing right now being in this part of the world is that all of the big organizations, right? Big championships, big sporting events are happening in the region,
mm.
right? So if they wouldn't happen in the region, I would be less here because I always have to follow where the big events go, right?
Yes.
But the beautiful thing is right now, since they're all competing against, you know,
tell us some who couple becomes of these events. Tell us some couple of these events you will be there.
FIFA 2022 was here, right?
No, new events.
We benefited. Asian Games Saudi 2034, right?
Okay.
With 2 years ago was the Combat Games in Saudi Arabia, right? The UAE Muay Thai Federation here in the UAE did an amazing job of really taking Muay Thai to the next level. They brought the Asian Games over in 2019. They brought the World Cup over in 2022, right? The Jiu Jitsu Federation is doing their World Cups here, you know, every year for the past 5 years, right? Which normally brings about 2,500 to 3,000 athletes to the country, right? All of them. You know, if it's a kickboxing championship, Muay Thai championship, Jiu-Jitsu championship, most of the events are here. Now the upcoming event, which is happening in the next 3 weeks from now, is Bare Knuckle Fight. It's a very big IP globally right now.
And this will be in Abu Dhabi?
It will be in Dubai.
In Dubai, well.
And you're participating as
one of my very close friends, mm-hmm. very, very close friends, who introduced me to everyone in Abu Dhabi, became the chief growth officer, right? And he helped these guys to bring them in here.
Yes.
So I'm playing my role of, okay, guys, whatever you need, we can help,
nice.
You know. So Tam Khan will also be a little bit supporting on this event. So again, we all help each other because we want these events to come here. We want these events to have a good experience here. Because when they have a good experience, they will come back. So the more big events come here, the less travel we have to do to go outside, right? So this is the beautiful thing right now, right? That us as eXports, all of our deals were always, and our focus was with international IP partners. And 90% of these IP partners are all attracted to the region because the region is amazing, right? And very aggressive in becoming the number one region of sports, right?
We will see you also in Tokyo 2049.
Inshallah. So that's the one. But I think another big focus for us right now, so the region is perfect. The competition, you know, in sports is amazing. Everybody will benefit, right? There is no reason to put people around and say this, that, that, and trying to leverage things. Just come in, you know, get a little piece of it and grow together. But I think a big interest for me right now, which I never had on the radar, but now I think it's going to be a very big opportunity, is the U.S. market.
Yes.
The U.S. market, I think in the next 3-4 years, is going to be one of the best markets in the world. Because when it comes to sports, yes, nobody in the world spends like in the U.S. Nobody. Mm. You know? Even there was like reports in 2022 when there was this big hype and the big, you know how you call it, big bubble right here, the big bull market. The amount of money raised in Web3 gaming or something in the US, yeah, right, was 10 times bigger than everybody combined, you know. It's amazing how big the market is, especially for sports. Mm. And now with Trump, you know, they're also crypto friendly, yes, right? So you don't have to be scared trying to do activations in the US. FIFA World Cup is there next year, yeah, right? So for us, we have an IP in football for the Urban Ball activations, which is a very good potential in the US market, right? Street football activations, ghetto style tournaments. There's a big, you know, culture around it in the US. So I think for the next 3 years, the biggest opportunity for us is also in the US market.
Awesome. So Tolly, really wanted to say, you know, thanks for the amazing discussion. Something that I really like about Demetrios, about our podcast, is we have such diverse guests. So we had Philip, who was very strong in AI and humanoids, or
humanoids.
Irina, who was a highly skilled lawyer. Talal, coming from brokerage, crypto trading. So, and today I have to say, I mean, we know each other, you know, yeah, and spoke many times very well. So I know very well what you're working on. But I think today, hearing your story, how you went in Muay Thai, yeah, and how you lost the four teeth and that brought you here today, I think it's an amazing story. And I just want to say, you know, keep on doing what you're doing because you're very strong and we need more companies and people like you in the Web3 crypto space as well. And I think today we went very strong. And it was just a great discussion. At least my personally really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Hvala, hvala. Translation means thank you in Croatian. Hvala.
I would also like to thank you for coming in our podcast. You are, I think, the first Greek that comes in the podcast, so I feel very proud.
Thank you, thank yes. you.
And
the first Malaka.
and I wish that we will get the opportunity to see you more. Yep. And I hope the future will bring you a lot of successes because you deserve it. You have an amazing story and an amazing will to fight to make it happen.
I appreciate it. Awesome. Thank you guys for having me. It was a pleasure to see you today, to teach you also about Greek coffee, Freddo Espresso.
I learned, yeah.
Freddo Cappuccino, which was the coffee we had before coming here, right? Yeah. But the guys don't know how to drink it. They f*** it in 2 seconds. In Greece, they would put them in jail for that. Drinking Freddo Espresso in 1 minute away. So I hope you're going to have more Freddo Cappuccinos and Freddo Espressos, properly, Greek
yes,
style.
Yes.
1 hour of talking and zipping like that. Yeah. And wish you also all the success, all the best. I'm happy that Anton finally moved here. When I met you first time, you're still based in Switzerland.
Exactly.
You didn't know if you're going to make the move or not. Yes. Right? So it's good to have you here right now. Dimitrios, I only met him, 1-2 months ago?
Yes.
Right?
By accident.
By accident. Not by accident. It was planned by the master networker, Andreas Tsingos. The master connector. So we had a very good meeting. We had kind of a similar conversation, but a bit more cursing because it's off the record, mixing with Greek language. And yeah, so it was very good to have this conversation today in a civilized way without any bad words. I hope we have not to cut anything and do this more often.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
And I really want to emphasize, would love to, you said more often, would love to have you again on our podcast in the future. By that, I assure you 100% I will learn how to sip Freddo Cappuccino.
Perfect.
Properly. Okay.
So. And I think the next podcast, maybe I can bring you Sean Garnier, the footballer. Sure. We had a podcast with him before. He has a good audience as well. He has a French accent, so we can, you know, fix it with the eye. We fix it with the eye a little bit. Oh, people are like a football. It's okay. So I think we could bring him. Or Tam Khan would be a good guest for your podcast to be here.
Yeah.
You know, he's a big, big guy.
I think the best one to be here will be you again.
Yes.
I'm sure you will have fascinating stories.
No, I think Tam is going to be more interesting. Tam is a funny character. But yeah, anyway, next time if I come, I have to bring one of the athletes. Because I think very important is also to look and hear a journey or a story from an athlete, right? Mm. And how they feel about the space. Because also a lot of athletes got burned in Web3, right?
Yes.
Right? You know, big names, unfortunately, right? Some of them benefited, right? 99.9% still don't understand it, right? But it's good to, I think, maybe have an athlete in and see what is their perspective, you know? And how they feel being here in the region that is one of the fastest growing in the world for sports in general.
Awesome. Inshallah for that. And was great to have you.
Thank you.
And thanks a lot to Oli, and thanks a lot to our audience and viewers, and wishing everyone still Ramadan Karim. And thanks, guys, everyone.
Perfect.